Welcome to Health Cetera. I'm Diana Mason, one of the producers of this program that's brought to you by the Center for Health Policy and Media Engagement at George Washington University School of Nursing. You can follow us online at www.healthmediapolicy.com. That's healthmediapolicy.com. And I'm very pleased that today we're bringing you a special program, and I'm doing it with my colleague, Kenya Beard. Kenya, it's always fun to do programming with you.
Yes, yes, Diana, it's always a pleasure to join you. I am so unbelievably excited about today's show. There are so many different opinions on what it will take to improve healthcare. Even our legislators can't agree. But today's show is going to expose our healthcare system for what it is and empower our listeners to discuss the real issues that influence health. So chances are we have or we know someone who has asthma, hypertension, or diabetes. These are serious illnesses that can kill. And medicine alone is not enough to manage these conditions. We have to eat healthy, avoid cigarette smoke, have access to health care, and that's just to start. But what if you live in a community where you don't have access to a grocery store, or the air quality is poor and not from cigarette smoke, or the unemployment and poverty rates are so high that your health is no longer your priority? These conditions are just a few of the realities that impact health for so many of us. First, the Morrisania section of the Bronx was once called a food desert, a place where grocery stores did not exist and access to fresh fruits and vegetables were inadequate. So how do you eat healthier? Secondly, in New York, there are some midtown districts where the air quality is at unacceptable levels. And what effect will that have on individuals who have asthma and work in those areas? And lastly, there's a direct relationship between poverty and health. So how do we really improve the health of our society when we know that a prescription for medication does not translate to healthier food on the table, better air quality, or employment? What are the lessons learned from our past that can be used to inform our future? Well, in the book, Out in the Rural, a group of men and women came together back in 1966 under the direction of Dr. H. Jack Geiger and opened the first rural community health center in the United States, the Tufts Delta Health Center. And during this time, you know, just to give you a backdrop, if black people were able to access health care, many had to use the back door, wait in separate rooms, or they were expected to tell the doctor what their problem was because some doctors would not actually touch them. And there's more than that. Because back then you could be denied access to a hospital if you couldn't pay, some actually died on the hospital steps. This community in Mississippi faced healthcare challenges that resulted in the highest mortality rate in the country. But that was all about to change. Dr. Thomas J. Ward, Jr. is here to share how the health of this community improved and the lessons learned could be used today to improve the nation's health. Tom is the author of Out in the Rural, a Mississippi Health Center and its War on Poverty. He is the chair of the History Department at Spring Hill College in Mobile, Alabama. He earned his Ph.D. in history from the University of Southern Mississippi and is an expert on the history of healthcare. He is the author of many books, including Black Physicians in the Jim Crow South. Tom, welcome to our show.
Thank you, Kenya. Thank you, Diana. I'm excited to be here.
Could you set the stage for us in terms of what drew... So this is really a story about Jack Geiger and his work to start a community health center in the Mississippi Delta in the 1960s. Can you talk about what drew him to start a community health center in the Delta and why he wanted to do this?
Yes, this health center grows directly out of the civil rights movement. Jack Geiger and a number of the other founders of the Community Health Center movement had been involved with a group called the Medical Committee for Human Rights, which was basically a group of doctors, white and black, men and women, northern and southern, who followed the civil rights workers throughout the South, 1963, 1964, 1965, and patched them up as they got beat up and things happened because many doctors in the South wouldn't treat them, hospitals wouldn't treat them, and so this organization got together and they volunteered to literally just patch up the civil rights workers when they were abused during protests. And what happened was during Freedom Summer in 1964 in Mississippi, DAC was part of a group of the Medical Committee of Human Rights, and they were going throughout Mississippi helping with the Freedom Summer volunteers, and they became horrified, and that word's not, I think too strong, at the conditions they found, especially in the Delta. And it led to conversations between them. One famous conversation in a Holiday Inn in Greenville, Jack talks about, where a bunch of these doctors were sitting around and they were basically saying, in essence, what the hell are we doing? Why are we here trying to help people, get the right to vote when they're dying of basic health, rudimentary health conditions, things that have been eradicated in other parts of the country. They're dying of malnutrition. We need to do something about their health before we can worry about anything else. We're doctors. And so that led to an idea that they basically funded out of their own back pockets. A small clinic that they founded north of Jackson called the Milston Clinic, where Dr. Bob Smith, who was a local, he was the local leader of the MCHR from Jackson, Mississippi. Bob kind of monitored it from his office in Jackson. He'd go up one or two days a week. They hired a public health nurse to try to care for people. But what they realized is that this was not nearly enough. Having one little clinic that was kind of partially staffed wasn't doing enough. And, of course, this is at a time when the OEO, the Great Society, is just developing.
The
and
OEO being the opportunity for the Office of Economic Opportunity under Lyndon Johnson.
That's right. That's exactly right, under Lyndon Johnson's Great Society, the War on Poverty. And Jack Geiger, who, when he was a medical student, had gotten a grant to go study community health in South Africa in the late 1950s. He studied under Sidney and Emily Clark in South African townships. He basically says to these other doctors, look, I had studied things that were very similar. I had lived, in South African townships, and we had developed these community health programs where the community was in charge. They helped determine what was most necessary. They were empowered to deal with their own health processes. And he says, if we could do it in South Africa, why can't we do it in the United States? So he and Count Gibson, who was a white Southerner, he was a Georgian, Count at this time was the dean of the Tufts Medical School. Jack was at Harvard at this point. They wrote a grant to the OEO. They asked for a demonstration grant. And what they wanted to do was say, look, we want to see if this is a viable model. We want to see if we can create community health centers in the United States. And they wrote a grant to see if it was be possible to do one northern urban area and one southern rural area. And they originally asked for $30,000 to just study the feasibility of this. The OEO was so impressed, they gave them $1.3 million to actually go ahead and create the first two community health centers. And Count Gibson was put in charge of the one in Columbia Point in Boston, which was a high-rise public housing program, and it dealt with a lot of the issues that Kenya was talking about: food deserts, not being able to have access to a doctor. People didn't have cars to try to get to hospitals to get to physicians was very difficult, even though they were in a big city. So Count was in charge of that one, and Jack was in charge of putting together and finding a location for the southern health center. He scouted a number of areas, but he finally settled on Mound Bayou, Mississippi. Mound Bayou is a fascinating place. It's in Bolivar County, Mississippi, which is in the northwest section of Mississippi, deep inside the Delta. It hugs the Mississippi River. It is cotton plantation country, and it was one of the poorest, if not the poorest, counties in the poorest state in the union. It had absurdly high maternal and infant health problems.
Highest mortality rates for infant mortality and maternal mortality, right?
That's right. Yeah. Had the highest infant and child mortality rates, infant and maternal mortality rates in the United States at this point. And so they said, well, that's a place where it'll be, in part because the health statistics were so bad, because they could say, look, you know, the infant and maternal mortality rates are so bad, no one can question that this is not necessary. We're going to a place where there's an obvious need. The other thing that they saw in going into Bolivar County was Mound Bayou is an all-black town. It was a town actually founded by former slaves of Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, back in the late 19th century. And it was, had essentially its own government. It was, even though it was in the Mississippi Delta in an era of segregation, it had been isolated in some regards from the worst ravages of segregation. It had its own government, it had its own hospital, it had its own businesses. It actually had two hospitals by 1965 when they were scouting these locations. And so Jack said, well, this would be a good spot. There'd be protection there. There's some infrastructure. And so they decided to put it in Mound Bayou. So the first center starts in Boston. A year later, the Mound Bayou Center, which will become known as the Tufts Delta Health Center, will open. Before they would open it, they had to deal with a lot of conflict.
Before you get into that, I want to note that, so for listeners to understand that here's the opportunity to start a health center in an underserved and unhealthy community, doesn't have good access to health services, and so you would think that it would be welcomed. So
yes,
the resistance that you outline in the book was sort of stunning. Talk about that. Yes.
Yeah, and there's some resistance they certainly expected, and some they did not. They expected resistance from the Mississippi government, which was an all-white government at this point, despite the fact that the Voting Rights Act had been passed in 1965. Of course, there was resistance in most southern governments to basically any federal programs by the late 1960s. So there's opposition there. They expected that. They expected resistance on the local level as well. And they even expected resistance from local doctors. And Jack spent a lot of time with the local medical society trying to convince them why this was good. Of course, there was a lot of talk about, if you're going to bring in cheap health care, you're going to be, taking money out of our pockets. And Jack said, look, these are people that are not being treated. These are not people that we're not taking your patients away. And he had a lot of fight with a lot of the local doctors.
Including African-American, black physicians.
Yeah. And of course, black physicians were the ones with probably the most legitimate fear,
yeah.
Because they were the ones that there were going to be some
that economic threat.
They were going to be threatened economically, especially the two black doctors that practiced in Mound Bayou, and so there certainly was resistance from them. Although there was only one black member of the local health department, and of course he had just recently become just desegregated, and he's the only one that voted actually for them coming in. They voted 50-1 against allowing the health center to be located in Bolivar County.
But you make an important point in the book about Jack was not discouraged because of the conversations that he had with other people who voted against it.
That's right. Well, and there were over 100
members. They were too afraid to speak up.
Yeah. So there were over 50 that just abstained from the vote, and they told him privately, "Yes, we want you to come here. You need to do this, but we can't publicly support such a program." A white physician in 1966, the Mississippi Delta. So there was some, you know, understanding that there was going to be support, but he's not going to get virtually no overt support, and even, like I said, a lot of resistance from black physicians in the area. The other, those were all areas of resistance that they kind of expected. They did not expect as much the resistance they were going to get from the local population. Mm-hmm. Part of it was just a significant amount of distrust that local rural blacks had from almost any outsiders at this point. And the key figure in kind of bridging the gap is a guy by the name of John Hatch. John's a fascinating character.
Yeah.
He's actually the first African American to desegregate the University of Kentucky Law School, but he left after a semester because the dean required that empty chairs be placed around him in all classes so he wouldn't be truly desegregating it. So he basically said to hell with that, and he left, served in Korea, and then went and got his degree in social work. And John's actually working up in Boston. And Jack recruits him. He's looking for community organizers to go to Mount Bayou. And John goes down to Mount Bayou, and he begins to try to get ingrained with the local black community, try to, you know, sow the seeds actually for this program and say, look, we're gonna bring this health center down. What are the issues that are important? And he was surprised initially that there was a lot of distrust, that people couldn't believe that someone was going to want to do this for them, that there in essence had to be a catch. So he spent a lot of time trying to find local leaders. One of the things that he worked very hard at was to find local leaders who were, you know, as he said, not the traditional black leaders, not the ministers, not the business owners, but people that were kind of leaders in their community in other ways.
You talked about in the book how when he came down, he didn't just come down with the idea of putting in a healthcare center.
That's right.
He asked the individuals what was important to them, and healthcare wasn't the priority.
That's exactly right.
Even though he came down with funding, and he did make a difference, but some felt at that time that he brought down a paternalistic attitude, and it was dismissive of what the residents that were there, what they had been doing for their community all along without funding. So how did he address those attacks?
Well, that was when Jack Geiger came down. You know, John Hatch kind of paved the way, and when the center finally gets up and running, John Hatch had already established 10 local health associations throughout Northern Bolivar County, you know, in these very small communities. And as you mentioned, you know, one of the things he said is, you know, we want to know what your issues are. And what he found out is that a lot of, you know, he was coming in and talking about a health center, and most people said, well, you know, we don't care about a health center that much. We don't have enough to eat. We don't have jobs. And as one woman, Pearlie B. Robinson, kept telling him, you keep coming down here talking about babies, but we've got issues with old people. Mm-hmm. And of course, they have statistics on infant and maternal problems, but they didn't really see that there was such a crisis with the elderly. And of course, part of the problem was the economy of the Mississippi Delta had changed so much very dramatically. You'd basically seen a collapse in the sharecropping system as cotton farming had become mechanized. And so you would have, you know, large numbers of people, you know, sharecroppers leave for Chicago and Detroit and other areas. But you kind of had a community that had a lot of elderly and a lot of young, and not a lot of people in the middle, and a lot of families that had previously taken care of the elderly were now gone. And so there were a lot of issues that John Hatch, through these community health center, through these community health associations, found out that people were having problems with, you know, firewood. They didn't have enough fuel in the wintertime. Food, of course, becomes a major issue for them. Elder care. And so when the center actually opens, there is kind of some resistance from some people saying, wait a minute, you know, you're not bringing the things we want. And so very early on, the center works to say, okay, we've got to adapt. And I think it's one of the great strengths of the center, because there is initially this idea that, okay, you guys are bringing us something we don't need. And there is a lot of work in that first year especially, and I think John Hatch is the critical figure there to say, okay, there are things that the people need that are related to their health, even if they don't even see that they're related to their health.
Let me just...
And that will also be an entree to getting us in with them.
Let me just remind listeners that you're listening to Health Cetera. That was Tom Ward. He is the chair of the Department of History at Spring Hill College in Mobile, Alabama, and a professor there. And he's the author of the book Out in the Rural, a Mississippi Health Center and its War on Poverty. And we're talking about the development of community health centers in the Mississippi Delta and in this country in the 1960s and the lessons that we can learn from that. I'm Diana Mason, one of the producers of this program, and I'm here with Kenya Beard, another producer with Health Cetera. So John Hatch was clearly a major force in the development of these community health centers, and it was very powerful what you wrote about the work that he did. And I wonder if you could talk for a moment about the empowerment and how you could see that these health councils were empowering people in other ways, and that the community health center itself, people affiliated with it, started seeing that if we pay attention to developing, whether empowering people to be active and see that they can change their communities, that they can get an education. Can you speak to that side of the work that came out of this community health center development?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, one of the things that they tried to do was, like I said, empower the local communities. As John would say, you know, we want to go where you are. You know, tell us what your problems are. And so, as they found out, there were a whole bunch of issues outside of maternal and infant health that they had not necessarily considered. And so, there were things like housing. There were things like sanitation. There were things like education and job opportunities. And so, the health center developed all types of programs to try to deal with these issues that, you know, related either directly or indirectly to health, what Jack Geiger and others have called, you know, the social determinants of health. And so when they found out that there were problems, one of the biggest problems was clean water. Jack Geiger had gone out and hired an environmental engineer, a guy by the name of Andy James, who was also a native black Southerner. He was from Birmingham, Alabama, but he was living in Ohio at this point. He was, and Jack recruits him to come to Mountain Bayou. And, you know, one of the things Andy finds is that the people there are dealing with just atrocious water and sewer sewage conditions. The argument becomes rightfully so that, you know, you can't send people back. You know, they can't come to the health center and get treated and then be sent back and be living in conditions that are just horrible for their health. And there was some frustration from the doctors that were working at the health center because they would give people instructions, you know, things as basic as baby formula. But then they'd find out that, you know, they're mixing this baby formula with water that was not clean. They found the types of conditions in a lot of these shacks. You get about 80% of the black population of Bolivar County in the late 1960s, did not have running water. So you had water supplies, large numbers of people, their only water supply was using 55-gallon drums and getting those filled, if they could, taking them into town and getting them filled from the municipal water system, or sometimes just filling them out of ditches or with rainwater. But no matter where they got the water, these drums, where they'd gotten these drums were off the plantation. These were drums that had been used to store pesticides. So even if they had gotten clean water from the municipal source, they were storing their water supply was coming out of, you know, was being stored in an old DDT barrel. So obviously that was an atrocious situation. So Andy James went to digging wells throughout North Bolivar County, and they didn't have a well drilling machine. So he devised a system. He got a 3/4-inch pipe, and he got two guys, and they cut off a piece of a telephone pole, put handles on either side of them, and they bang this this pike 12 feet into the ground, and if they got it deep enough, it's about 12 feet, they could get clean water in the delta. And they put, Jack Geiger said, we had all these orange-handled, you could drive through the delta and see orange-handed pumps, and that was us. So, you know, getting clean water was an issue.
And talk about food, because I was surprised. I thought, here they are in the Mississippi Delta. Why can't they farm their own food?
And, of course, food is related to these issues. You know, food was a huge problem. And of course, part of it is the Delta. The Delta was and is, as it still is, cotton plantations. And, of course, these are people that are not living on their own land. They're living on someone else's land. And so a sharecropper can't grow what they want to grow. They're working on what the landowner wants. And, of course, the landowner wants cotton planted up to the edge. And even when they started to talk about, could we get an acre here, an acre there, you can't put an acre of vegetables next to a cotton plantation because the pesticides that are going to be sprayed on the cotton are going to make your vegetables unusable, you know, unedible. So you've got a huge problem. You've got a huge problem there. And so they didn't have enough. The option of kind of growing your own family garden was not there. On top of that, you had a change with the development of the food stamp program. Before the food stamp program, from the 1930s to the 1960s, the U.S. government provided a commodities program. Well, basically, you know, excess farm commodities were distributed to the poor. You know, things like flour, cornmeal, sugar, stuff like that, cheese. That gets phased out and replaced with the food stamp program. The problem is you had to have money to buy food stamps, and sharecroppers in the Mississippi Delta were so poor. The average income of blacks in Bolivar County, Mississippi, when Jack was there, is $800 a year. That's for a family. And they could not even afford to buy food stamps. So the food crisis actually gets worse in Bolivar County and much of the Mississippi Delta as a result of going to food stamps. There were also other issues with food stamps. The government, you know, used all types of, nefarious things to keep food stamps from people, especially if they had been involved in the civil rights movement and what have you. But beyond that, it just had to do with an economic issue. So the food crisis is acute. And, Geiger and the other doctors saw this, especially with children. They saw tremendous amounts of malnutrition in Bolivar County. And it developed, you know, what became one of the most famous and one of the most controversial programs that Jack Geiger developed, what he called the food prescription program. Mm-hmm. What he started doing was writing what he called food prescriptions out of the health center's pharmacy budget. He would write prescriptions for milk, for eggs, for bread, for cheese, and he got into some agreements with a couple of the local black grocery stores in the county, and they would pay for they would accept these prescriptions from the Tufts Delta Health Center. And provide food, and the health center would then pay that bill out of their pharmacy budget. Well, you can imagine when word got back to Washington and the OEO that they were using prescription money, the pharmacy budget, to pay for food, people were really upset. And they called up Geiger and said, "You can't do this." And he said, "Why not?" And so, that's money for medicine. And he said, the problem is malnutrition, and the medicine for malnutrition is food. And he said that was so absurd they couldn't argue with it. And what they ended up doing was actually writing in food prescriptions into the budget. And so, he stopped having to kind of do it on the fly, and they actually created a program where the malnutrition crisis could be handled at least a bit through food prescriptions. The larger issue is something John Hatch and Jack Geiger came up with, which is a farm co-op. As you all mentioned, there's this kind of incongruity of the people living on what was really the richest land in the country, this rich farmland, and people starving. A big part of that, of course, is it's being used to grow cotton, use cash crops. But people there didn't even have the skills, really, to grow a lot of food. And so what Jack Geiger had told everybody, look, when I was in South Africa, they had community gardens, and the community gardens were used to let the school children basically augment their diet, that they could go pick out of the gardens and at lunchtime and add to whatever their diet was. He says, can we do that here? And John Hatch started to see if they could do it, and he thought he'd get maybe a couple dozen people that would be interested, and he got a couple hundred that were interested. So he said, we can't do a community garden. We need more land. And so Geiger and Hatch worked very hard to kind of beg, borrow, and steal land in the area. They got some local landowners, some black landowners and some white landowners, to either give or sell or rent land to the co-op. They got donations from the Ford Foundation. They got donations from Coca-Cola. They got donations from Jolly Green Giant. So they got some corporate money. The OEO also provided money. And they were eventually able to get a couple hundred acres to develop a farm co-op. Now, this is going to be something that's now going to be, you can keep it away from the pesticides of the cotton plantations. And the idea was families could join the co-op for $1 a year, and you would work on the farm, and then you could take basically your pay in either cash or vegetables or a combination of both. And some people joined it, and they would work, and they would donate their food to people that, you know, needed it but couldn't get out and work it. So the farm co-op was really kind of the most creative of all the programs to try to deal with this food crisis. It'll eventually fall apart in the 1970s for a whole host of reasons, in part that they try to make it more economically viable, and they get away from they start planting some cash crops, but they also lose funding from the OEO and other groups. But it was designed to, once again, kind of empower the community, that the community was going to own this land, the community was going to work this land, and they were going to benefit from this land. And the co-op also opened up, you know, dealt with other crises in the area. They opened up an African-American bookstore. They opened up a record store. They opened up a lunch counter, basically a little restaurant at the health center. And, of course, those things provided jobs for the population as well. They'll have a frozen food locker that will operate for a couple of years that will, one, obviously, you know, freeze some of the vegetables so they can have them year-round, but it also employed a couple people. So the idea behind the
So wait,
co-op,
John, did all those other businesses fail when the farm co-op failed?
Some of them failed before the farm co-op did. The one that was most successful and that actually outlasted the farm co-op was the lunch counter inside the health center. That one, of course, had a good audience. The bookstore and the record store failed before the farm co-op failed. The farm co-op doesn't fail until the mid-1970s. The bookstore and the record store only last about 2 years. They had a recycled clothing store that lasted about 2 years. The problem was with a lot of things was money. They weren't trying to make money on these things, but they couldn't be losing money constantly on them. And the OEO funded them for 3 years, and the OEO said, well, you've got to become basically self-sustaining after that point. And, of course, right when the funding was running out, it was in the middle of the Nixon administration where these things were – OEO programs were being phased out entirely anyway, so money was not being re-upped. And so – the co-op really, like a lot of these programs, really kind of has its knees cut out from under it. You know, its most successful year is 1971. They have over 900 families, and within a couple years, it'll be dead. In part because they couldn't make it self-sustaining.
So Tom, you just brought up what was happening back in 71 with Nixon phasing out the OEO and then providing block grants, which
yes.
gave local politicians the funds to allow them to decide where the funding would go. But Jack, even before 71, in the late 60s, he was saying that if we allowed politicians to decide what they would do with the funding, that the community's health would fail. So
That's
what was
exactly.
Jack seeing that the rest of society was not seeing?
Well, of course, this, you know, you talk about the block grants, and that's tied to what Jack was talking about, is that, and of course, Jack is going to run into problems with the local communities. You know, one of the problems Jack had faced and did not expect to face was there was also a lot of resentment to him, basically as a white guy from Massachusetts coming into an all-black town and running a lot of things, but also a huge resentment over the amount of federal money. So there was resistance even from local black leaders, and of course a lot of that fight was over money. So just having the money in the local community's hands, I think, is not doesn't mean everything's going to work perfectly, because the health center will face problems in the 1970s when it controls a lot of the money. But certainly in Mississippi in the 1960s, 70s, you could take it all the way up to today, the block grants, if you're going to let things be organized on the state level, it's going to often hurt the poorest communities, those that are least empowered. And, you know, one of the arguments that was made was, Mound Bayou doesn't need a health center because they have a hospital. You know, they have a black-run hospital. Of course, they had a black-run hospital that was in very bad shape by the 1960s, and you know, Jack had to help get OEO grants to kind of even keep that hospital alive. And so certainly, there's problems with, a top-down strategy in making sure the money gets where it wanted to go. And that was where Jack was trying to empower the local community to decide what needed to be done. But there were tensions there as well. I mean, I think that whenever you deal with large amounts of money, there's people get self-interested. And certainly that was one of the problems that the health center found in the 1970s.
And let me remind listeners that we're talking with Dr. Thomas Ward. He is a professor and chair of the History Department at Spring Hill College in Mobile, Alabama, and he's the author of a fabulous book. Both Kenya and I have loved reading this. It's called Out in the Rural, a Mississippi Health Center and Its War on Poverty. It's published by Oxford Press. And I want to point out that it has a foreword by H. Jack Geiger. And Dr. Geiger is still with us, lives in the New York City area, and this is a largely his story. It's partially his story as the founder of the Community Health Center in Mount Bayou, Mississippi.
Tom, I was going to ask you, the conflict that you're talking about in 1966, yes, it was about money, it was about power. No one wanted to relinquish their power. In fact, they wanted to gain more power. They wanted to take this funding and use it for other reasons. And it was also about race. So we have money,
yeah,
power, and race. And now, 50 years later, how has that conflict changed any, if at all?
I think there's so many parallels. And you're exactly right. Those were the three conflicts, money, power, and race. And, the last part of the book, I kind of bring it up to, current debates. And when I was researching the book, one of the things that was fascinating was reading things that Mississippi politicians and physicians are saying in 1965, 66, 67, 68, 69, and you could have been, reading them in 2009, 2010, 2011, as we were talking, as we were debating the Affordable Health Care Act. So much of it has not changed. The issue of, let local people control, let states control things. Why do we need the federal government telling us what to do? That, of course, was an argument we hear today. It was an argument, literally today I heard on the news about the proposed changes. And it was an argument that was certainly made in the 60s, and it was made when both local and state politicians were trying to get the federal money that was going to the Tufts Delta Health Center and control it themselves. And so that was certainly a huge issue. It is an issue of power over who's gonna control not just these monies, but who's gonna decide what is relevant. What is healthcare? In my story, this of course is a civil rights story, I think, as much as it is a healthcare story. And one of the issues is, who gets to decide where sewers get built, and what part of towns get plumbed? I talk about in the book that you know, the Tufts Delta Health Center actually enters into a lawsuit, becomes known as Shaw versus Mississippi, that will eventually go to the Supreme Court, that says you cannot, you know, states are not, or localities, not even states, localities are not allowed to provide services to one part of a town and not to the other side of the town. Because literally you had towns, you know, we talk about, you know, the other side of the tracks. You had towns in Mississippi and in other parts of the country as well, but this dealt with Mississippi, where the black part of the town had no plumbing, had no paved roads, had no electric lights, had no sewage, whereas the white part of the town had these things. It wasn't that the town was poor. It was that the city government said, well, we're only going to plumb this part of town. And, you know, I say, you know, we're sending men to the moon and bringing them back. And in the Mississippi Delta, you know, you've got human waste running in the streets when it rained. That was not because they couldn't do it. It's because they didn't want to do it. So power was certainly there. And of course it was certainly tied to race, because it was the black parts of Shaw and Alligator and Rosewood and these other small towns that were the ones that were being discriminated against. And the health center is going to be very important in developing a cadre of leaders and empowering people. Johnny Todd is one of the first black mayors in Mississippi after Century Construction. He'll lead a boycott in Rosewood, Mississippi, to get sewers built. He'll later be elected mayor in the early 1970s. L.C. Dorsey, who was a civil rights worker, a sixth grade education, ends up getting a job working at the health center. Will eventually run the co-op, then go off, get her GED, get her college degree, get her master's degree, and come back and run the health center in the 1980s and 1990s. You know, she said, you know, this was an incubator for leadership. And part of it was just providing people that you could see. Andy James, who I mentioned earlier, ran the environmental health programs. He started to recruit people to be sanitary engineers. He said, young high school kids, junior and high and high school kids, they don't think about being a sanitary engineer. And so he would go and, you know, most of them didn't even aspire at all to go to college. And so he would find these students that were interested in science and said, have you thought about being a sanitary engineer? And he helped get them into programs. The first black sanitary engineers in Mississippi all came through the Mound Bayou program that he set up and found scholarships for. One of them, is on the board of directors of the health center today. You know, so this guy that kind of got his start as a high school student learning from Andy James, you know, became a sanitary engineer and comes back and is still with the health center. So it was
Tom,
an incubator for leaders.
What you're describing, Tom, is comprehensive health care. So it existed for a short time in Mississippi, but how did we become so far removed from that? There's a quote in your book, and it says, to treat symptoms and then to send patients back unchanged in knowledge, attitude, or behavior to the same physical and social environments, also unchanged, conditions that overwhelmingly help produce their illnesses and will do so again, is to provide antibiotics for cholera and then send patients back to drink again from the Broad Street pump, which was contaminated water.
That's right. That's exactly right. And now some of those things have changed. You know, we talked about the Shaw case. You know, a lot of the programs, some of the programs of the health center were eventually taken over by local government. They were forced to. But obviously there were a lot that are still not. You mentioned the food deserts earlier. Aaron Shirley, who was one of the physicians that worked at one of the first physicians that worked at the health center. He was a black Jackson, Mississippi physician. Aaron Shirley talked about, in 2010, I think it was, he said, you know, in the 1960s, poor black communities were dying of starvation. Now they're dying of food, that the food they're eating is so bad because the food deserts don't provide any healthy food. You can get all kinds of empty calories. And so in some regards, that's a situation that changed, but it didn't change. You know, he said, now I see so much diabetes and all these other problems. So poverty certainly still breeds all types of poor health conditions. You know, water. I mean, what have we been talking about the last couple of years with Flint? And of course, as the Flint crisis has, you know, has been exposed, we're finding out that other cities have similar problems.
Right.
Maybe not as extreme. Maybe some, maybe even more extreme. You know, I know I grew up in Maryland, and there was something about Baltimore. The kids in Baltimore City schools, you know, can't drink the water in the schools because all the water is contaminated. There was something that I was reading the other day, you know, in West Texas had a situation just like Flint. And so those crises are still here, and you know, as we all know, they hit poor communities much harder than they hit wealthier communities.
So Tom, I think a question that Kenya and I have talked about in reading your book is, we haven't learned. Why haven't we learned? So what are the lessons that we should be taking from the story of Mound Bayou in Mississippi and the brilliant work of Geiger and John Hatch and others? What are the lessons we need to learn? And one question I have is the health center still there? And if so, what is it? Is it still doing the same kind of work? Or I believe one of the impediments is that you have too many regulations that dictate what a community health center, particularly federally qualified health centers, must do, and doesn't give them the freedom to really be flexible in addressing the needs of the community. That our payment policies have continued to reinforce that we pay for medical care, not for health care. So I welcome your thoughts on this. We only have a few minutes left.
Well, I'll do it backwards. First, the health center is still there. In fact, they just opened a brand new building that's named after Jack Geiger. So the original health center has been repurposed and named after Andy James and John Hatch, which can be an education program. They have a brand new, I guess it's 2 years old now, facility named after Jack Geiger. The center is still there. What started in the 1970s with the cutting of a lot of funding to help community health centers was that they went to what Jack Geiger called a leaner and meaner model, which is kind of what you were talking about. Mm-hmm. Programs that didn't seem to specifically deal with health, education programs, environmental health programs, sanitation programs, those things were weeded out. And what the federal government says, those are not health. You know, health is providing well baby checkups, providing immunizations. That, I think, you know, that changed from those creative solutions that Jack Geiger and others wanted to deal with the social determinants of health in the 1960s. Those things were, in essence, killed off with budget cuts in the 1970s and 1980s and have still not come back. Now, some of those issues have been changed. Like I said, a lot of the environmental problems of sewage have been fixed. Some of them in the poorest parts of the country have not. The health center today does not do the things it did in the 1960s, although it's a wonderful facility and they do a lot of good work, although they are talking about bringing back a community garden to try to do something like that. I think the lessons that we've not learned is we still don't deal with these entire social determinants of health. Once again, you could turn the news on today and hear people talking about, well, if you're sick, it's because you're not, you know, it's because you're not living right. You know, and instead of taking into account people living in places, you know, like Cancer Alley in Louisiana, or you know, the water in Flint, or the poverty of Appalachia, or the Mississippi Delta that continues, or the food deserts of New York or Baltimore or Chicago or New Orleans, where people can't afford good food, and saying, well, you know, and not seeing how those things go, and so those are the issues I think we haven't grasped.
But there is a growing movement, though, that's recognizing that we must address these social determinants of health. And as I was thinking, what are the lessons that I would walk away from in relationship to the integration of these? One has to do with the importance of a John Hatch and the community organizer and somebody who knows, is with the community, knows the community, and is able to empower people at a grassroots level. You differentiate between, or they differentiated between, the elite leaders and non-traditional leaders, and really trying to empower local people to become leaders, that it's shared leadership with each person bringing their own interests and perspectives and energies to a change in a community. So what else might be lessons that we could take with us as we today try to look at how to integrate the social determinants of health work into our concepts of health and the policies around health? I mean, it seems one of them seems to be that we need to get away from models that are paying just for medical care.
That's right. I think that's the biggest one. But you talk about local leadership, and I think the community health center movement has done that. I mean, like I said, the community health centers provide more health care to Americans than any other single service. Over 25 million Americans get their health care from community health centers throughout the United States. And so they are significant, and they are all run by the community. So they are not top-down programs. People think that, oh, it's a federal government. They get federal funding, but, you know, they take insurance, they take Medicare, Medicaid. You have to pay. No one is turned around for not being able to pay, but you have to prove that you can't pay, basically. So they're not free, and they are determined by the needs of the community. Community boards run the community health centers. So a health center on an Indian reservation is different from a health center in downtown Los Angeles, or is different from a health center in rural Alabama. I think that's an important lesson, that the community needs to be empowered. One size doesn't fit all, and of course cultivate those local leaders. And I think that is that's one of the great lessons of this book is the local leadership that comes out. But I think the other thing is we tend to we've been in a society for years that is kind of poo-pooed anything government can do, and the Great Society and the War on Poverty have been kind of viewed as disasters from both the left and the right for a long time. The community health center movement's a great example of the not only the success of the Great Society in this instance, but of things that good government can do and shouldn't just be dismissed out of hand. That have injected money into an incredibly impoverished part of the American nation in Mountain Bayou, and was able to engender not only better health but a better economy because of it. It was it was a tremendous economic boom to that area, and developed leadership.
Well, Tom Ward, I want to thank you so much for first writing this book. It's out in the rural, a Mississippi Health Center and its War on Poverty, published by Oxford Press. I assume people can get it on Amazon.com. Do you know if that's so?
Yes. Yes, they can. They can get it on Amazon.com. Yep, it is there.
I think it's particularly important today, as you were just talking about, when people are thinking that whatever government does is not okay, and that we need to get government out of our lives. And this book is an illustration of the good that government can do. So I want to thank you so much for writing this book and for coming on to HealthCetera with us.
Great. Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
And Kenya, it's always good to work with you.
Likewise, Diana. Thank you.
So you've been listening to HealthCetera. I'm Diana Mason, and one of the producers of this program with Kenya Beard, Dr. Kenya Beard, my nurse colleague. You've been listening to HealthCetera on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. You can follow HealthCetera online at www.healthmediapolicy.com. That's healthmediapolicy.com. WBAI.org.